the Antoinette system and tune in to the Pearl White system at RadioArian.com.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Wednesday, the 26th of June, 2019, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioArian.com. Well, as it's Wednesday, that means I have a co-host with me today. That means I have the revisionist historian Carolyn Yeager from CarolynYeager.net with me. Carolyn, how are you doing today?
I'm doing real well. Thanks.
Excellent, excellent. That is good to hear. And I hear you've been sort of looking into the Tory election, the Conservative Party election over here in Britain a little bit recently, and I think you had a few questions about it. I've been concentrating on it quite a lot, actually. So, what were your thoughts on it?
Well, yes, I was looking for news about it, really, because of the Brexit controversy and problem, and which nobody seems to be able to solve there. And I was struck by the fact that the leadership of Britain right now seems to be between Boris, tousle-haired, kind of childish guy, seems to me. He might be okay, but anybody who's a grown man and wants to wear his hair like that for some kind of reason, I don't know, seems a little questionable to me. And then Jeremy Hunt, who I looked into, I don't like his policies much. And then Jeremy Corbyn, the later leader. And then you have Nigel, who I used to like Nigel, but now I've just kind of cooled on him a little bit. I mean, anyway, these four don't seem to be of the level of statesmen that we always associated with Great Britain. You know, and Great Britain, so powerful, so important. So everybody looked to them, and they had so much influence. And now you look at these people who are there to run it, and I was like, my gosh, this is pretty pathetic. So I think I want to ask Sven what he thinks about that.
They don't really seem to have much leadership potential, do they? I'm not enamoured with either of them. But Jeremy Corbyn, I think, has integrity, and I will give him that. I disagree with all of his policies, but he does have integrity. He does believe in them, even though they're wrong. Boris Johnson, he says whatever he thinks is going to win him votes, basically. Jeremy Hunt, he's got a Chinese wife. He's absolutely dreadful. He voted to remain. He's just Theresa May in trousers. Nigel Farage sold out all his supporters by calling them Nazis and far-right thugs when half of UKIP voted for Amory Waters. So that's the situation. None of them are any good. But if Boris Johnson does become Prime Minister, he will then have to fill his cabinet. And I think he'll have Jacob Rees-Mogg in there, which would be fantastic. He'll also have Peter Bone, who's also good, John Redwood. And these are all really good proper conservatives, basically, people that do want to conserve things, which I think would be great. But the problem he's got is they're saying that he is not going to be able to leave the EU by October the 31st, which is what he's promised to do. And they're saying he can't do that because the Conservatives have only got a majority of four. And if he tries to do that, that's half the Conservatives aren't going to go for it. There'll be a vote of no confidence, and then there will be a general election. In which case, Nigel Farage has said, if you have a general election and you do a deal with me, I will either stand down the Brexit candidates or we'll tell our voters to vote for us, because the Brexit Party are leading in all the polls at the moment. So he could do that. And the other thing he could do is there's a court case that they're keeping quiet about at the moment by a guy called Tilbrook from the English Democrats. And he says that according to law, we've actually left the EU anyway, and everything the government have been doing is all a charade, because the Article 50 said that if you don't have a deal by April the 29th, you've left. So he says, we've left, and the courts are refusing to actually, or they're delaying actually hearing his case. And I think that's because his case is true, and they have actually left, and they're just going on with the charade. So Boris has got two options to actually leave. So he could feasibly do that, and I think we're going to be told which one of the two it is on July the 22nd. So, but none of them are leadership potential, but at least I think Boris would be better than Theresa May, who I think is the worst prime minister that I can remember in my memory. She was just absolutely dreadful. So that's my summing up of it anyway.
Well, that sounds a little more hopeful than what I thought, because I was making the prediction that that there would end up being another referendum, which shouldn't be done, but anyway, that's what would it end up. And they would vote to remain, and that would be the end of that, which is kind of disastrous.
Well,
but
there is
see,
a group trying to do that.
You don't think that's the way it's going to go?
Well, there's a group trying to do that, and they're trying to form a coalition to do that, to try and bring down the government and say, well, we've got to have another referendum. That's what he is up against.
Well, I think Jeremy Corbyn is saying that.
Yeah, you got Jeremy Corbyn. He hasn't openly said that, because he actually voted
to
leave.
Well, I saw something yesterday, maybe, in which he said that would be what was going to have to happen, as though something like that, you know. But that's why I was a little surprised, and I thought I'd look into it more.
Well, that may be what they're planning on doing. The other option is that Boris could prorogue Parliament. He could just say to them, don't come back after your summer holiday until November the 1st. And by the time they come back, Britain will have left the EU, in which case there's been this guy called Rory Stewart, this absolute total wet drip, who was putting himself forward as leadership. And he's been saying that if Boris does that, then they'll hold their government parliament or whatever in this other building that's next door instead of in the Houses of Parliament, because that's another option. But Boris Johnson has said, we will leave no matter what on October the 31st. And that's the only choices he's got, either with this legal case, having a general election and doing an alliance with Nigel Farage, or proroguing Parliament. And that really is the only options he's got. And the rest of them will be trying to try and get another referendum through. That's what they want. Or a general election. Jeremy Corbyn wants a general election, I think, but I don't think he will if Farage forms an alliance with the Conservative Party, which, you know, that could be quite good, really. I mean, Farage is still Farage. I mean, he'd be a good influence on them, I think.
Yeah. Well, okay. That's it's good. That was good for me to hear. Well, I want to go on to a story that keeps coming up. I think because the powers that be, you know, are in the controlled media in Germany. They're pushing this idea, but you know, they keep telling us that the Angela Merkel's party, Christian Democrats, have announced it's absolutely impossible that we will ever work with the alternative party, the AfD, in any way, even in any way, not just to join together with them, but to have any kind of a political cooperation with that party. And it just strikes me, and they say that with so much righteousness, it just strikes me how undemocratic that is, and how can they even say that? Because it's the alternative party is a democratic party too, and it supports the Constitution and the basic law and a lot of things that I don't care for, but and it's completely pro-Israel, anti-Semitic, all of that stuff. And so how can they get away with that? But they do, because they just insist, like the spokesman for the Christian Democrats gave the reason for why they won't work with the alternative party is that party tolerates right-wing extremist thought, anti-Semitism, and racism within its own ranks, meaning that they don't stand for any of those things, and they don't preach any of those things, but they have members within their party who have been caught on Facebook or something like that, you know, saying things that they interpret as anti-Semitic, racist, and extremist. And maybe some of them are, to their point of view. But all parties have a big range of members. And that's what the alternative party says. We have a range of members. And I think I'm very happy that Gowland has said that that they don't go around kicking out their members just because they don't follow along what some others want, that they have a little bit of independent leeway there. And that's very good. So, but they do this because they're scared to death of them and they want to criminalize them. You know, even something like the AFD, they want to criminalize in some way so that they don't have to deal with it. And of course, this guy named Friedrich Merz, Merkel's one-time rival, when they were all running for the leadership of the CDU back when a ways, and one of the contenders who lost, had told the Bild newspaper that the CDU was hemorrhaging voters in the more conservative wing. Well, he's a member of the CDU still, and he's had some higher positions in that party, and he made the comment that they were, you know, of course, and that's true. It's known that much of the growth of the AFD has come from CDU members who are unhappy with what they call Merkel's move to the center and to the left rather than staying on the center right, and her immigration policy. And he said that this hemorrhaging of voters was particularly among police officers and the military. So, you know, they're scared of this. And how do they handle it? By cracking down on the alternative party and saying, you know, and they've all said this from the beginning, but, you know, that we're never going to work with you. But, you know, they keep getting stronger and they're in all the parliaments and they're in the national parliament and they're doing very well and, you know, very active and so on. And so I just think, you know, that what's going on there is so just the way that they keep throwing around this idea of democracy, but what they really are is very controlled and media controlled states that are enforcing the post-war globalist agenda and can't tolerate any challenge to it. So
it's hypocritical, isn't it? It's absolutely hypocritical to claim to be democratic and then try to shut down another party that's been voted for democratically. And if they've got that many people that they're in parliament, then that means they've got a lot of votes. It means they're popular. I don't understand how they've been able to make populism into a dirty word, because the whole point of democracy is that whoever is the most popular gets voted in. And yet they've said, well, populism is terrible. Populism is wrong. We must shut this down. I don't understand the difference between it, because that's supposedly all that democracy is about is who is the most popular. And as soon as somebody becomes popular that they don't like, they instantly want to silence them. I heard this week that they wanted to give a 3-year prison sentence for anyone that wants to burn the EU flag. I mean, that's saying that their loyalty is to the European Union more than Germany. What they're saying is that they're going to form a pact and make some kind of law to prevent the CDU ever working with the AFD as some kind of make it into some kind of pact, so that if the AFD do become even more popular in future years, there'll be this either a rule for the CDU or something that they put into law to say that they will never work with them. So they can sort of refer back to that and they can say that was Angela Merkel's legacy. She got the CDU to make this pact never to work with the AfD in case they can foresee in the future that the CDU, you know, might get pushed further and further towards the AfD. And then they can say, well, look, we made this agreement that we'd never work with them in 2020 or whatever. Is it a legal thing that they're doing, or is it just, you know, they're just saying, well
I don't know. I don't know about that. I don't think that would work because the AfD would take that to court and they would probably win because that doesn't sound like something they could do. But it's more likely, seems to me, that the CDU will keep hemorrhaging like the Social Democratic Party is doing, and the Populist Party will just become more in the, might gain a majority. And so that's how that would hand, they wouldn't be able to do anything about it. So that would be the end of, you know, the parties in Germany, the leading parties are changing. You know, the Greens right now, because of the continuing poor performance of the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats, the, you know, the two mainstays that were ruled everything for so long, are doing so poorly, as I said. So the Greens have become the number one party. It may not stay that way, but that, you know, it's not, they're not way ahead or anything, but they have. And so that's a big shift that's already taken place. And it may not go back because it seems like the Green Party is both liberal, plus it has a lot of things that new young voters like, all that environmental stuff. And so the AfD is kind of has, in a recent poll, they did 1 point better than the Social Democrats, which would have, you know, just a couple years ago would have been unheard of. Shocking. But it's happening. So they don't know what to do. But now, the other thing I wanted to mention was that what's going on with the Social Democrats, they're doing so badly. Their voter share has shrunk from 25% to 15% in 6 years since they've been in Merkel's coalition government. It's not been good for them to be a part of her government. And they're now competing with the AfD, because at around 15%. And so they're trying to figure out what to do because their leader, that woman, she stepped down because their last election was so bad. So they have this group of two women and a man as temporary, but now they've decided, they've made a decision, and they're going to adopt a double leader model for their party. That means they're going to have two leaders, one man, one woman. And that's what the Greens have been doing for a long time, although it doesn't get a lot of attention, but they've had a guy, a woman, and a man as co-leaders of their party. So the Social Democrats are going to try this, and
who's going to have the final say? Who's going to have the final say? I mean,
well, I know. Yeah. I mean, how are you going to run a party like that? I don't think that's workable. The Greens have not been, you know, in a leading position up until just recently. So I guess that's worked for them. But and actually, I think this woman is more in the spotlight than her partner, than her co-leader is. But I think it just shows how desperate they are. They're just striking out to find something new to say, well, we're going to refresh ourselves in this way. But I don't think that's going to bring in more votes.
It's like the center will not hold, and people are just splitting off to the left and they're splitting off to the right. So they're going off to the Greens and they're going off to the AfD. I mean, that's really good news that the AfD are ahead of the Social Democrats. And if the CDU are saying, well, we're never going to work with the AfD, then you could see eventually the AfD with more than the CDU. You know, if they're fighting against the Greens, what they really need to be doing, I guess, is coming up with some environmental policies as well as the anti-immigration ones, which really is just natural. If you're a nationalist, you care about your country as well as your race. And you would imagine that they would have good environmental policies and maybe get some of the Greens on board. I know the National Socialists are all about the environment and the Clean Air Act, and nationalists before then as well were all about the environment. It's only very recently that the left have hijacked that. You know, I could see them managing to get those people back on board that would be leaving to go with the Greens, the youngsters, do you think?
Well, yeah, I don't know. They're kind of quiet, you know. I mean, they're coming out with pretty ordinary, normal positions. I think they're trying to look, you know, play down any kind of extremist, reputation that might develop from anything they say or do. So I think they're being kind of quiet now, leading up to these very important elections in September.
Which ones are those in September?
Those are in the eastern states of Saxony, Brandenburg, and Thuringia, and they are where the AfD is strong, and they are going to have state elections. So that's where they say they might. It's possible that the AfD could end up with a state premier in one of those states. And anyway, they want to do very well there. They're expected to do well. If they don't do well, they would look bad. So, I don't think they want to rock the boat too much. That's why they don't come out with anything that I find really interesting. So even people like, Bjorn, the guy who has made statements that are so infuriating to the German establishment, because he questions the way Germany conducts its Holocaust and World War II remembrance and so on. Bjorn, I can't think of it, but he hasn't said anything for a long time. You know, it's always very interesting, but they make a big thing out of it, you know, and start screaming. So I just think that's what they're doing. I hope they know what they're doing, because we count on them so much for keeping this move, this change in Germany going. It's slow but sure so far. I think the new leader of the Christian Democrats is not very popular and has not been doing a very good job. She hasn't really taken off, you know, she hasn't connected. So that's not helping that party at all. And Merkel just keeps coming out with her her usual stuff, and she's very uninspiring. So
the AfD have got all the, they've got the energy. The AfD have got the energy behind them then with these elections coming up. You just mentioned about the Holocaust there, and I know there was something about the Holocaust that you wanted to bring up. I think
want to bring that up now. I've been commenting at UNS Review, which is a kind of an interesting experience, and there's all kinds of people there who are in very different levels of knowledge and understanding, and so it's kind of pretty frustrating a lot of the time. But there's been a lot of the Holocaust is very popular. Every time that comes up, anything to do with it, there's tons of comments about it from, you know, all sides. So it stimulates my interest. And I noticed this article at DW that it was kind of a stock thing. It didn't get a lot of attention. It's not news or anything, but it was about this author, an Israeli author who wrote a book about the Holocaust, and called The Memory of the Holocaust Has Become a Monster. But what's interesting to me in it is that he's emphasizing the impact on Jews of the Holocaust story today. You know, I mean, it's like, it's not about the actual, and this has come up at UNSI, it's not about the actual Holocaust narrative as it was created back then and has been, you know, never been repudiated, the 6 million in the gas chambers and the plan, you know, the systematic state plan to exterminate all the Jews. So instead, now it's morphed in all the conversation, particularly by the promoters and the Jews, about all kinds of things, you know, that hurt Jews, you know, that Jews suffer from, and so on, and just so now this book, and they, another thing that bothers me is that Jews write so much; they're very accomplished with words and writing, and they write hundreds of books and hundreds of articles all the time. You know, you just inundated if you want to be with all their points of view and all their stuff they write, and so so this Israeli makes the point that the Holocaust still has an intense impact on Israeli and Jewish life, both on a personal level as a family trauma and on an institutional level. And their emotions, all the emotions that stem from it, like hatred and animosities, go in so many different directions that you can't control them. And he feeds those hatreds, I think, you know, in a very sickening way. This article was an interview, and the interviewer said to him, "Many young Israelis live in Berlin, and both in Israel and in Germany, you'll find German-Israeli couples." Now, his answer was, "I don't want Israelis to hate Germans, but sometimes discussions about the Holocaust between Israelis and Germans are almost like talking about a common experience about how Germans are so sorry and we accept the apologies. It becomes too cozy. What I say in the book is that the line between the killers and the victims should be distinct. It's not a common experience to the tune of, you killed and we were murdered. We should keep this clear." Well, what he's saying in his way there is that let's remember, you're the killers, we're the victims, and we should not get too cozy together. Well, I agree that Germans and Jews shouldn't become cozy. I don't like that idea either, but not for the reasons he says. You see, this is shades of Elie Wiesel and his statement that every Jew should keep a place of hatred in his heart for Germans, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Similar to what this author is saying as well, isn't it? Because he's getting angry that Jews are going to Auschwitz and they're getting annoyed at Poles, or they're getting annoyed at Arabs. And he's saying that they need to be hating Germans. They can't be hating the Poles. It must be the Germans that they're hating. It seemed to me that's what he was getting annoyed at. There wasn't enough hatred against the Germans.
Seventy years later. Yeah, you know, they just want to keep this thing going. They don't want to deal with the facts. Is that one point I want to make here, that if we deal with the facts of what the Holocaust is claimed to have been, they lose, because it's been shown again and again, and people are getting it. More and more people are getting it, it seems, but maybe there's more and more people all the time. So it takes forever to reach enough of them. But
there's definitely more people waking up to the truth about this. And you see it in the comment sections.
It's about the facts of the Holocaust. But so they want to get into all these side issues, which are like, there's a fellow commenter at UNS who I just learned about, just came into this thread. But he's been there back in the past. He's really, really good. And he said something that I thought was very, very significant. And he said that in its original guise, the Holocaust referred to the state-mandated systematic attempt by the German Nazi government to eliminate all or a significant part of the Jewish population in Europe, unquote. And is often added principally by means of gassing in purpose-built facilities, which brings in the gas chambers, and ultimately eliminating millions of victims. But he says later, Yad Vashem changed it to a definition as the sum total of all anti-Jewish actions carried out by the Nazi regime between 1933 and 1945. See, they've just changed it, what they mean by the Holocaust. They've made it into all these more vague things. It includes stripping German Jews of their legal and economic status in the 1930s, which means the Nuremberg Laws. So now the Nuremberg Laws are part of the Holocaust. Segregating, that means the ghettos. Ghettos are part of the Holocaust. Starvation, which I question when they say starvation, because the only starvation I know about is at the end of the war because of the Allied bombing, when everything was shut down and nothing could move and food couldn't get anywhere and so on. That's the only starvation I know about. And this new definition, he says, opens the back door, allowing the Holocaust to slip out of the realm of historical inquiry into the realm of tribal lore. It treats the subject, well, I say then, I try to explain this by saying it treats the subject as if it were about ancient Jewish sagas, like what does it mean to the Jews, rather than as a recent and real event that we can discuss. See, so he says, can it still be called a Holocaust at all? What is a Holocaust? And this is what's happened. This is exactly what's happened and what they're doing on purpose. And it becomes a... It makes it impossible
to actually prove
it wrong, you know, because as we've done. But now they've just, you know, confused it with all these other things and give credence to whatever complaints Jews have.
Well, it's going to cause them to trip up, isn't it? The more and more exaggerations they add, the more crazy, wild stories they add to it, the more likely it is that people are just going to think, oh, hang on a minute. Hang on a minute. How many gas chambers did you escape? How many times did you get into the prison camps and back out again? How many diamonds did you swallow and poop out the next day?
If they pay that much attention, Sven,
well, I think people are.
Unfortunately, most people don't. Although it might be growing, and that might be an illusion. I don't know. I tend to always be on the negative side, I guess. But here's the thing. This makes it, what they're focusing on now is anti-Semitism, because if the focus of the Holocaust is all these things that were done to Jews because they were not liked, and now if you don't like Jews, that, you know, means that it's equal to a Holocaust. So they have to pass all these laws, and they're working away on passing laws, and you're scared to think they're getting closer in the United States.
Especially in Florida. We know how much they love to say something is another Holocaust. They can redefine just criticism of Jews Holocaust.
This anti-Semitism definition that they're trying to get passed everywhere, and it is being passed continually more and more places,
is
the most dangerous thing.
Started in Britain, it was a Holocaust Society that came up with it.
Yeah.
With a new definition of anti-Semitism.
Some kind of alliance. Yeah. Alliance is in the name of them.
And it's basically just criticizing Israel. Any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism. Well, anyway, we've gone a little bit over time here, Carolyn, but that's excellent. Thank you very much for coming on. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. God bless and hail victory.